So I'd like to give some context to the practice that we've been exploring together up to now, and that we will also explore till the end of the retreat. And there's no better context than speak about the fundamental teaching, which is called the Four Noble Truths. Very succinctly compounded words, the Buddha expressed his intention. He said, I teach one thing and one thing only. There is suffering and there can be an end to the suffering. So this is a very exquisite, wonderful teaching. And he really saw how all human beings, wherever they are situated on this planet, on this earth, all human beings want happiness, lasting happiness. And yet, this happiness is so often misunderstood. And there may be a confusion between happiness and pleasure. Pleasure, we know. Lasting happiness, a little more difficult. So we really sense that all these Buddhist schools, whether you're in the Tibetan tradition, whether you're in the Zen tradition, take this teaching to heart and really have it be the fundamental teaching that all traditions will agree on. They don't agree on everything, I tell you. But on this teaching, they do agree. And it's called the turning of the wheel of the law, meaning the law of Dharma, the law of nature. And so you can ask maybe yourself, why are they called noble truths? Well, the word noble here, again, in the same way that we talked about noble silence, they're just noble in the way that they lead to freedom. They really lead to something quite noble. If it's the end of suffering, there's no doubt that it's noble. And so, again and again, it's a practice. We practice these four truths. It need not only be understood intellectually, and no doubt that if you hear the teaching, you will have some probably intellectual understanding of it, but it's not enough for it to be a teaching which really directs us, helps us go all the way to the end of suffering. These teachings need to be applied, put into practice. And it's exactly what we're doing here, right? There's no doubt. Quite intensely, actually. And there's a way that we have the imagery of a physician, right? A doctor with an illness. And it's a very clear way where we can really understand it quite directly. The first noble truth is really relating, as a physician will do, there is a sickness or there is something ailing. The second noble truth will say there's a cause for this illness. The third noble truth is there's a medicine. And the fourth noble truth is, how do we take this medicine? How do we apply the path? And so this is exactly what we're doing here, following a path to be able to recover from the illness, move into the direction of the end of suffering. So the first noble truth needs to be seen. We need to see very clearly what is happening here. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering, needs to be understood, but not understood only intellectually, experientially. Right? Third noble truth, kind of the medicine, we need then to realize the truth, right? Realize the end of suffering, And the fourth, well, exactly what we're doing, developing a path, meaning really going into a process where we understand from experience, moment by moment, the way to the end of suffering. And of course, what we have is mindfulness with many other qualities along with mindfulness. There's no doubt that we've seen this a little bit already last night. So I'd like to speak a little bit about each one of these truths. The word for suffering is dukkha, right? And dukkha means quite a number of things, actually. You know, we have this sense where suffering is a big word. But as soon as there's some dissatisfaction, some stress, some frustration, some tension, some discontentment, there's dukkha. So it's a really very broad understanding for the word suffering, right? Dissatisfaction, not okay. And today, of course, the word stress is so clearly something we can tune into. As soon as there's stress, there's dukkha. Okay? And so this dukkha, we can really allow ourselves to come into terms to being able to already know, oh, this is what is happening. There is stress here. So much of the time, we are so busy that we are not living with the connection close enough to really realize until suddenly something very big happens and suddenly we say, oh my gosh, this level of stress. So there's no doubt at times the tendency to live in denial of this truth. And that's exactly what the teaching says. We live in denial or we're too busy to be exploring and to really taste this truth that, yes, indeed, there is pain here. There is stress. So from his first discourse, the Buddha says this: birth is dukkha, old age is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, and grief are dukkha. Right? Contact with what is unpleasant and separation from the pleasant are dukkha. Not getting what one wishes is dukkha. This is exactly what we're seeing moment after moment, right? So our usual mode is to kind of avoid. We don't want to meet that kind of truth, right? So we get very busy, and when we are not busy, we entertain ourselves just to find a place where we can connect with something a little more pleasurable, which is totally fine. But are we in denial of something? And very clearly this teaching suggests exactly the opposite. Not to be in denial, not to be completely distant or kind of ignorant of this fact, but actually to come closer, to really face. And why is this form so incredibly challenging? Because we're just that. We're really asked to face, to understand it deeply. I remember being quite reactive on my very first retreat, really understanding that there was a way that I understood that the Buddha's teaching was talking about dukkha, but I had not realized that I would be in a situation where definitely, in the very same way that we are here, really being face-to-face with it. And there was a lot of reactivity in my mind saying, I came for the end of dukkha, not to feel more, which of course we probably are discovering this. And it's fascinating to notice that it takes some time to understand that the way out is through. And that the whole kind of strategy that we have in relationship to constantly avoiding ourself in reality, because this is exactly what we're doing when we're in denial, is actually the cause for feeling a little more pain, or a lot more pain. So he explained different aspects of dukkha, and I think they're quite valuable. So there's a conventional understanding. The first one, of course, is as soon as we have a body, at times it will ache, right? There's no doubt. That's the conventional understanding of dukkha linked to the body. We all suffer body aches and pains, and at times excruciating pain, right? When we're sick. So it's dukkha to have to deal with these bodies that at times don't function so well. And I can tell you that the more we're aging, the less pleasant it is to feel the truth of this body, because it's part of the aging process. And exactly this, the aging process is something which every one of us is going to be encountering. Right? So there's no doubt that we are here in a place where we can meet this truth. And it's fantastic to notice everything that the world today can offer to try to prolong youth. Right? All the different kind of medications we can take, all the kind of ways that we can even, you know, have an appearance where we have a way that we can look like 20 years younger. Nevertheless, there is going to be a day, up to now at least, where old age, sickness and death are part of what we're meeting. It's just completely normal. It's the human predicament. Even though we're quite successful at living longer. That's quite amazing. If you think like 50 years back, you know, people would die much earlier, actually. And it's quite amazing. So we're kind of gaining time, but eventually this truth is here for us. So there is this aspect of dukkha, very conventional, that if there's a body, there is going to be a decay, and there is going to be an end, right? Then there's a real way, real sense, where we can feel the dukkha in relationship to our turbulent minds. There's a way that we can really see how much we can be annoyed in relationship to what is happening in our minds, you know? And it's amazing, because before I meditated, I had no idea. We don't look at the mind so closely. In meditation, we begin to really sense, and I don't know about you, but it was quite shocking for me to notice all these thoughts, how harmful, unpleasant, really not very kind thoughts that were emerging and beginning to emerge in the mind. And they were there, except that they weren't seen. And so we begin to see, wow, this is really amazing. Not only are these thoughts there, not seen, and we're in denial, but sometimes we can feel that they annoy us, and sometimes even they can really handicap us, incapacitate us, really hold us back. Thoughts of fear, for example, thoughts of judgment. So this is definitely something that we need to see. So the first truth, we need to look into. Look into the mind, look how the body is functioning, how we can notice the aspect of this conventional understanding there is suffering at times in the mind and in the body. Now the second aspect of this first truth is dukkha that goes a little deeper. Contact with what is unpleasant and separation from the pleasant is dukkha. not getting what one wishes is dukkha, right? It's painful. And we really sense, even though we can try to have some settings and realize our life in a certain way, and we can actually, in this part of the planet, there's no doubt that we have some level of comfort, safety, and harmony. So we can, in a certain way. Yet, life doesn't always go the way we want it to go. That's the truth. There's no doubt that at times we're separated from what we like. And there's always the case also that we have to tolerate what we don't like. And that's the truth, right? So we begin to sense how in the realm of connection we have this tendency for ourselves, and also in extension, this tendency to want life to be perfect. And that sense of wanting it to be perfect, me needing to be a certain way, is dukkha. Life needing to be a certain way in relationship and in accordance with my expectations is naturally something that will create dukkha. What this teaching suggests is that we cannot at all levels have a control over the specifications, have it always our way, because life changes. Even if you can really, you know, kind of strategize and have it your way, there's an aspect where we really sense that there are other causes and conditions, and change is happening. And suddenly, whoop, we're no longer in the capacity. And so this is stressful. We're still in this realm of the First Noble Truth. It's pretty stressful, because in those moments, then we really feel the vulnerability. And that vulnerability of, I can't really control what's happening here, is of course a cause for more dukkha. And therefore, this is what we're going to be encountering. There are unpleasant experiences in life that we can pretty readily identify, right? Just the other day, unfortunately, I had my toes in the door, and someone slammed the door. And it's the kind of little pain, you know, it's not tragic, yet those little pains, because we're so sensitive, they cause so much pain. Immediate effect. Oh my gosh, this is so unpleasant, you know. And I went through really the pain that was felt in my mind and also in the body, and said, wow, where did this come from? Just a while ago it wasn't happening, and suddenly you don't know. What a surprise, what a shock. And how much capacity to receive this in the best way possible. You know, of course. So there's stress in the unpleasant experiences, just like the one I described. And we probably, each one of us, have examples of this, where suddenly something happens in our life. But what is interesting is that the Buddha also describes that there's stress in the pleasant experiences. Why? Now, this does not mean that there's a denial of the pleasantness, that there are extraordinary, beautiful moments in life. Encounters, meeting, nature, these days is just extraordinary. And we can really allow ourselves, and thank goodness that we can, experience the beauty of life and appreciate the kindness, the care of other people. Fantastic moments, right? But there's a tinge of dukkha. Why? Because we have the truth that actually it's going to change. And we know this deep down. It's interesting because we do know. This is why we can't completely get lost in the fantastic, extraordinary moments where it's really pleasant, when we begin to sense deep down the truth of this dukkha, of this stress. Pleasant turns into something which doesn't last. So there's change. Times with my husband these days are very special because of our schedules. We don't see much of each other. And so we just had 2 days together just a week ago. And it was really interesting how my mind was kind of going back and forth from, oh, this is so nice. It's just so nice to be together, and really taking in the joy, just the joy and the pleasantness of that, having a good time together. And going into, oh, but it's not going to last. It's only 2 days, right? And how much it can prevent then from having this very clear time together. And the more we are aware, the more we're present, the more I say, no, let go of that thought. Just enjoy. Just be there for the encounter. And take it in, because this is exactly how we are creating more stress when we don't allow ourselves to really feel the pleasantness, the appreciation, the contentment. And so much of the time we miss on life because if we're already imagining something that's going to end, then it prevents us from having the joy. But life is fleeting. You know, so it is fleeting. And then, of course, there's a translation of this dukkha as unsatisfactoriness, that ultimately lasting happiness is something extremely difficult to get in the world of causes and condition, because conditions change. In the conditioned world, there is going to be a way that it's astounding to see the dilemma that we are in relationship to change. Okay, so we really understand this. The third kind of suffering is exactly that. The third kind of dukkha is the existential suffering. Just to be with the constant kind of movement of the mind, or the constant impact of the sense doors, right, that there's kind of an impact, and there's even maybe a need to care for this body, there's a need to feed the body, to really take care of it, is a way that can be stressful at times. And there's no doubt that I really feel, you know, today kind of this palpable existential dukkha for so many beings that are just in a mode of survival, to find shelter from places that are unsafe or find food. It's amazing. I mean, it's amazing how in 2014 so many beings are displaced, dislocated because of wars, because of violence, because... So this is the existential kind of suffering. If we don't feel it for ourselves, there's no doubt that we can have this way that we can sense this. So these are all the different kind of aspects of dukkha that the Buddha very clearly describes in his teaching. Does it sound depressing? Maybe it does, but maybe it, for me, it was really so incredibly insightful when I heard this teaching for the first time. And I know that for some of you it is the first encounter. Because actually it came as a relief. That it is part of life. So much of this culture that I was brought up in is exactly the reverse. That life is perfect, we can get what we want, and if we don't, there's some kind of dismay that something is wrong in me. That I'm not up to what life is expecting of me. A personal deficiency. And when we have this way, which is a wrong view, it's a myth. It really is a myth. So this teaching for me was such, I mean, it really touched my heart. I remember I cried so hard, like being a relief to see this is part of what existence is about, right? There's nothing wrong with me if at times I am really feeling low or stressed. Suffering is happening as part of life. It's inherent. So it can be helpful, actually. And especially if we have a tendency to live in a society where there's an avoidance of reality and we live at a frantic pace. I mean, maybe not here, but definitely there's a way that we get numb by entertaining ourselves because we're so frantic and we don't really know where it's all going, actually. We have no idea, actually. But this constant need for stimulation to avoid feeling, in a way, is also dukkha. So there's a very positive side, this side that when we begin to feel, as the Buddha said, there is also suffering is a call for seeking. This is what may bring you here, in a way that instead of being completely depressed, there's a way that it inspires our search. And no doubt that that's exactly what it did for many yogis, where it's an inspiration to really see more clearly rather than avoid or distance ourselves from life. So all of this teaching is an investigation to embrace more of life, all of life, not to narrow down and to close down in relationship to having certain conditions be a certain way. And Ajahn Chah has a wonderful way that he expresses this. He says, there are two kinds of suffering. The first is the suffering that causes more suffering, that we repeat over and over and over again, that we lost in, that the samsara that I talked about last night, right? Habitual patterns. The second is the suffering that comes when we stop running. The second kind is the suffering that can lead to freedom. Every time we're mindful, we are where we actually are. We stop the running and we expand our potential for freedom. So this is exactly what this teaching is offering us. Opening to the fullness of life. Amazing journey. Now, there's no doubt it requires quite some courage, right? As you probably noticed. Why? Because actually, when we begin to open, we move out of the habitual mode and we're not really sure what we're going to find. So it's kind of an opening door to the unknown, a little bit. And yet, when we try to have everything under our control, to stay in the known, in the familiar, this is exactly the cause for staying caught into the suffering. Because the unknown may offer something much nicer. Who knows? Right? No doubt, some people are very attached to their suffering because it's known. We know it so well, so we prefer at times live in our very narrow, small world rather than explore the big world and just allow ourselves to feel a little bit more about what life is about. So there is resistance. And actually, this is exactly what the Second Noble Truth is speaking about. So the second truth, the cause of dukkha, is a truth that must be understood experientially. This is exactly what we discover now. The cause of dukkha is called thirst or craving. What I called wanting and not wanting, the sense of reactivity. And naturally, ignorance. Not seeing clearly what causes pain. So it's resistance. That's the cause of dukkha. When we're blind to the fact of really noticing that constantly craving for pleasant experiences and trying to avoid the unpleasant, that really are both roots. They're both roots for a way that we are caught in reactivity and not allowing, opening, to feel exactly what is emerging, accepting and living our life more fully. We're creating a cause for reactivity and narrowing down our potential for freedom, for really feeling more open. And what happens then? More restlessness, more agitation, less ease in the body, less ease in the mind, and of course more pain. So we can see wanting pleasant, not wanting unpleasant. This is kind of the double bind, right? And we spend an amount, actually huge amount of time coming into relationship between one and the other. I want the pleasant, I don't want the unpleasant. And this is exactly what we're going to be meeting a lot of the time in our practice. Because instead of playing this out, we begin to meet this reality, this truth, which is constant. It's so tiring to be in this space where we're fighting or fleeing, fighting or fleeing. Contraction and tension comes about. Now, we cannot find freedom without this meeting, without really being in the face of how is it that pushing and pulling is happening in me in each moment. And this is exactly what I talked about in relationship to the attitude. It's so helpful to understand this. Now, when we are in the space of relationship, we can sense very clearly that it's in the very feeding, when we feed the wanting and the not wanting, that we are caught into the crutches of craving, of the cause of dukkha. And this is really deep down ignorance, because we don't understand that life is all about change. Right? Pleasant is happening, it's present, we allow it, we appreciate it, and there's an end to it. It just doesn't last forever. Unpleasant, there's an end to it. And so this wonderful constant flow of changing experience, where the Taoists call the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows, just are part of what we meet. Life presents wonderful, beautiful things, and not so beautiful things. And it's just really a very big understanding, deep, deep understanding, when we begin to understand both, that we can't have one without the other. When we begin to understand that experientially, we begin to relax. It's amazing. There's a huge shift in our way of relating to life as a whole when we begin to understand that change is just part of life, in the same way that we understand that dukkha is also part of life. And the Buddha says this quite poetically. He says, "Thus shall you think of this fleeting world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream." So quick, so amazingly quick. So we're not a thing, it's a process. And nature is a process, and we are part of nature. So we are also clearly a very dynamic process. And when we are allowing for this process to unfold in a very natural way, then it's just like the flow of the river. Instead of trying to constantly go against the stream, we go with the flow. And this is exactly the opposite of reactivity. When we try to react and stay and go against the gradient, right? There's no doubt that we are in a space where we contract constantly, not knowing this is exactly the cause for our pain. Contract is to try to control. We want to be in control, and it's amazing because we're not very successful. So this is really what we call craving, and there are different forms, and we'll be able to understand that, of course, there's craving for sense pleasure, right? We want pleasant sensory experience. But there's also craving in relationship to becoming, the sense of self, this me, this I, me, who I am, how I want to be seen, how I want to be feeling so clearly looked at, the sense of me, of self, that as anything else is not a solid, permanent entity. It's also a way that we are so much more fluid. We are a verb, right? There is a wonderful way that this being that we are is also dynamic. It changes, it grows. And so if we have this way that we are stuck in an entity that we notice as permanent, as a concept, as an idea, we'll suffer. So this is the craving for being or becoming. And we can directly experience this truth slowly, slowly, as we practice and deepen the understanding. The way that we constantly, in a way, construct a self, a sense of me. And then there's the opposite, wanting to be and not wanting to be, which is the other aspect of craving for non-existence, right? So in relationship to life, it's like one moment it will be craving to be seen, right? I want you to see me. I want you to accept me. I want you to be in the presence of my very longing to notice, to be noticed, right? Longing to be noticed, to be seen. And then the next moment is, no, I don't want to be seen. I don't want to be seen. And that's exactly that, craving for non-existence. Don't look at me too much. So it's suffering when we are in this double bind again of relationship. So So we start to understand how the sense of self always looks for something, maybe an approval from somebody else, approval from, and then when there is, it's, oh, but not too much, see? And there's a pulling back, a push and the pull in relationship to me, who I am in this world, and in relationship to, of course, other beings, interconnectedness. So this naturally also needs to be understood, right? So this can go very deep, actually, because the practice is offering something extremely deep in relationship to finding freedom. Slowly, there's a good news. We begin to experience the third noble truth, which is also an experience. And notice the potential for the diminishment and even at times the total release of that dukkha. And what is the end of dukkha? The end of craving. Nothing else. The end of craving is really exactly synonymous also to the end of ignorance. We see so clearly what causes the pain and how to allow ourselves to diminish it at first and at times feel completely the end of that struggle, end of reactivity. And in those moments, we are not the victims of our life, but we really are, in a way, not lost in the craving, but completely aware of whatever manifest is wanting and not wanting, or sense of self that wants and sense of self that doesn't want, but seeing it clearly as movements and not getting caught, not being the victim of the desire, the aversion, and the delusion. And so, of course, there are different ways to speak about the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. Sometimes you may have heard the word Nibbana, right? And it's really clearly not a place, right? It's not like, you know, paradise, we can have kind of put it in a place. It has nothing to do with a place, and it's not something to reach. It's not a thing. It's not a concept. Really, what it means, it's the unbinding of the habits of craving. That's all that it means. It's the unbinding or the cessation of that craving. And more do we experience this, that we understand the truth of the freedom of suffering. And of course, there are different interpretations about this, right? We can interpret this as different traditions will speak about the end of dukkha. There's dukkha, there's the end of dukkha, the end of suffering. But here again, all of the traditions will agree on one aspect. They all agree that Nibbana, or the end of suffering, is the end of greed, hatred, and delusion. And this is doable, right? The end of greed, hatred, and delusion is something which we can experience, and we have experienced, maybe very briefly today, but we have. And so it's so great, because some people even speak of temporary Nibbana. Like Buddhadasa in the Thai tradition, he really speaks of a moment of Nibbana, which means just a moment where the mind is not caught in grasping, not caught in clinging. And there's freedom, there's ease. And we really sense this. Wow, how did I get there? And of course, we want it back, so we do everything to get that experience once again, and we're again caught in the conflict and the reactivity. But the release is something which is extraordinary. And I think it's so helpful when we begin to appreciate more and give some awareness, some mindfulness, to appreciate the release. Because it's happening, yet we are not really taking this into account because we're so caught in wanting it again or wanting it to last that we're again in strategizing and doing and pulling and pushing and pressing and interfering. But this release is our natural state. The end of craving is really the natural state when there isn't any conflict. Peace is available. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, happiness is available. Please help yourself to it. So really, it is available. But it's not the happiness of just pleasant sensation, a moment of comfort. It's really a lasting happiness. And as one teacher said, there is no need to struggle to be free. The absence of struggle is in itself freedom. When we stop fighting, struggling, freedom is available. The end of craving is freedom. So any moment we can realize this truth. It's fantastic. So we hear it, we may be inspired or daunted. And yet we say, wow, there's a possibility, there's a potential. And actually, this is exactly what made me continue the path. Really, this very teaching, saying, I heard it and I say, wow, this is so true. Because what touched me so much also is the fact that it's not based in belief. You know, so much of kind of spirituality, oh, you have to believe. You don't have to believe anything. You just test it, examine, and really try it out. Experience it, and just see. See for yourself. And in that way, you'll have a way that you'll see clearly if the absence of tension, the absence of struggle is freedom. So it sounds nice, doesn't it? Now, how to do it? Well, this is exactly what we're here for, right? The path that we walk on, that we cultivate moment by moment. And it's making peace with life in a way that we open progressively, gently to receive, explore some balance, and also explore our reactivity from a place of balance. And we'll get lost in the reactivity, but we find ourselves again, right? So this is moment by moment we are staying interested in our conditioned reactions, grasping aversion, right? And mindfulness is naturally the guide. As we get interested, we are less the victim, or we're less subject to attachment and aversion. And the less we're subject to attachment and aversion, the less there's ignorance, the more wisdom there is, the more understanding comes along. So this is the invitation. And hopefully we are in a place where we can really sense this and slowly begin to understand that there's a way, a path. So I'd like to end with a line from the Buddha, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's one of the sutras. He said, all conditioned things arise and pass away. Work out your liberation with diligence. Now, a kind-hearted diligence, not a forceful way, right? This is the way. So I think developing a sense of lightness, of kind-hearted attention, is the way, actually. And it can be the only way. Because in this way, we begin, and it's probably the first thing that we start noticing, is that even though there is reactivity, there's a sense of spaciousness, right? There's a way that we are not completely caught in the trouble or the dukkha. And this is exactly how he describes it in the Majjhima Nikaya. Develop a mind that is vast like space, where experience both pleasant and unpleasant can appear and disappear without conflict, without struggle, without harm. Develop a mind that is vast like space, where experiences both pleasant and unpleasant can appear and disappear without conflict, struggle, or harm. So this is exactly what the mindfulness gives us as a support, where more and more there's a possibility, potential for spaciousness. And just to end, one last quote here. What we have to learn in both meditation and life is to be free of attachment to the good experiences and free of aversion to the negative ones. Good and bad have absolutely no significance, no meaning in relationship to awareness. Life unfolds according to conditions that constantly change, according to previous conditions. This is where the true freedom lies. Understanding this will allow us to live free of expectation for the good and free of aversion for the bad. This is deep, right? Because this is exactly where the expectation is. Expectation for the good and aversion for the bad. So to live much more freely in a space where there's potential for true peace. So this is the task at hand. Wonderful that we can be here together to accomplish this task. Thank you.